3,000 watts of power and covering Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And you can listen to us live on AM 1160 or WMET1160.com, or get the archived shows by going to the newly redesigned WMET website. The show will be archived as of Tuesday afternoon. Right now on our live line, we have Dr. Yitzhak Levine. His bio is so long, I would spend all of our interview time reading it. Suffice it to say, Dr. Levine has a PhD in mathematics from the University of Maryland, but apparently he flew the coop and went elsewhere. He's on the staff at the Stevens Institute of Technology, has been on the staff, a professor there for many years. He also is a columnist for Hamodia, a daily newspaper catering to the Orthodox community, and he has become an expert in American Jewish history. Good morning, Dr. Levine.
Good morning to you, sir.
Well, good morning. And what piqued our interest is an article that I saw in Hamodia, and I believe it was in other publications also, an article entitled "The Jerusalem Rabbi Who Met President Ulysses S. Grant." So we want to talk about that. But first, if you can just give us an idea as to how a scientist like yourself, dealing in math, a career dedicated to college teaching, got involved in writing about American Jewish history.
Okay, it'd be my pleasure. About 6 years ago, I became interested in American Jewish history, but I have to say that my interest is not in general American Jewish history, but my interest focuses on people who were observant and did their best to maintain their observance during periods when it was not particularly easy. But, for example, the Jewish community in New York City, which started in 1654, by 1700 there were a grand total of 300 Jews in that vibrant Jewish community, a very small group of people, and they were faced by a challenge which Jews in Europe were not faced by, namely the challenge of an open society. The Gentile society around them welcomed them, and this was a difficult situation for many. There was some assimilation. On the other hand, there were those who maintained their religious observance. I became interested in this, an editor of a newspaper said that it would be very interested in a column in American Jewish history that focused on Orthodox people, and I said I thought I could write it, and that's where it started. I don't just write for the Hamodia. I also write a monthly column in the Jewish press called Glimpses into American Jewish History, and that began about 5 years ago. It appears in the first issue of each month. And this thing has just sort of developed, and it's become sort of like a journey for me in which I investigate certain things and find out certain things and write columns.
All right, so tell us about this Jerusalem rabbi. Who was he? Why did he come to the United States, and why did he want to meet with President Grant?
Okay. First of all, his name is Chaim Tzvi Schneerson.
Is he related to the Lubavitch dynasty of the Schneerson?
He was a great-grandson of the Baal HaTanya, Rabbi Schneer Zalman. A great-grandson. So definitely he is related. He is related. He was born in either 1834, and in 1840 his family moved to Eretz Yisrael, which was in Palestine, and he studied there, and he was a student, and by the time of his bar mitzvah, he actually received smicha. He was ordained as a rabbi. And beginning in 1860, a little before that, he began to travel as a mishulach, as a collector for various communities in Eretz Israel, for Yerushalayim and for Hebron. And by 1860, he had been to India, Persia, China, and Australia to raise funds for the poor in Yerushalayim and in Hebron. Now, one has to understand that traveling in the 19th century was not easy, so it's really quite amazing that he had covered so many countries. He also spent some time in Romania. But he came to America not with the idea of collecting money, but because of something else. The American consul to Palestine, to Jerusalem, was a Christian who was also a missionary, and he was attempting to convert Jews to Christianity. In fact, he had made a concerted attempt to convert a Jewish girl. And Schneerson came to America with the hope that he could meet with the president, who was Grant at the time, President Ulysses S. Grant, and convince Grant to replace this consul. And amazingly enough, he met with Grant. By the way, I should point out that Schneerson, when he traveled, the way he looked, we have a portrait of him. He's a very striking and stunning figure. He wore a white robe over a long yellow vest, a thick black colorful belt, and a red oriental fez. And the portrait just shows him a very striking character. And in this outfit he traveled, and he managed to get an interview with Grant, which was unheard of, but in some way or other he got an interview with Grant, and he made an appeal to Grant to replace this consul. And one of the great or rather amazing things that occurred was that indeed that consul was recalled, and a new one was assigned. So he actually accomplished that goal. After being here a while, he traveled, by the way, throughout the United States lecturing. He learned English. Well, he probably learned English in Australia, I assume. But he learned English. He traveled. He lectured widely. And he had been in Romania, and in the 1860s, he met with Grant in 1869, in the 1860s, the situation for Romanian Jewry was terrible. They were discriminated against, they had been displaced from their farms, their business had been confiscated, and Schneerson got the idea that perhaps he could influence the United States government to appoint a Jewish consul to Romania. And actually, he was successful in that. He wrote to Grant, and he had behind the scenes he was working, and a gentleman by the name of Benjamin Franklin Peixoto, P-E-I-X-O-T-T-O. He is from a famous Sephardic family. His grandfather was a Chazan in Sheret Israel in New York, was actually appointed the consul in Romania. So he really had accomplished some rather amazing things. Now, as he traveled across America, he spoke in many, many places. And he wrote a book. He wrote a book of his experiences. And in the front of that book, he had letters of invitation from various places where he was invited to speak. And what I think to be perhaps the most interesting letter is one that says the following, if I may.
Sure.
Salt Lake City, Utah, November 1870. Rabbi H. Z. Schneerson, San Francisco. Dear sir, in reply, permit me to say it will afford our citizens much pleasure to have you address them in the tabernacle on the subjects of such deep and abiding interest to us all as the past history and present condition of God's covenant people Israel. If possible, please inform me a day or two in advance of your coming when you will be here, so that the people may be notified through the press of your intended visit and the tabernacle be prepared for your lecture. I remain, dear sir, very sincerely yours, in the cause of Israel, Brigham Young.
Dr. Levine, this is Marcia Kay. I'm sitting here with Michael. I have a couple questions I'd like to ask you about the rabbi's trip across the United States. First of all, you said he took a trip across the U.S., I guess, from New York to California.
Yeah, on the Continental Railroad, which had been finished the year before.
Wow, that's amazing. Where did he stop besides Salt Lake City?
He stopped in Chicago. He stopped in San Francisco. He didn't. I don't know, by the way, if he ever spoke in Salt Lake City. I was not able to determine if he actually spoke in the tabernacle. By the way, some people say they thought that no one except Mormons are allowed in the tabernacle.
That's what I thought.
That's what I thought also, but here we have the invitation, okay. But in any case, he went all the way to California. He stopped in various Jewish communities in Cincinnati and in Chicago and other places and spoke. And then he came back also, and he spoke in New York too. But he took the Continental Railroad. That's how he went across the country.
What did he talk about?
Actually, his book has many of his speeches. He was very much concerned about the situation of the Jews in Palestine, as it was known then. And in most of his talks, he stressed the idea that the Jews would soon be given control of Eretz Israel. He proposed plans for the return of the Jews in large numbers to Eretz Israel and for the building of a viable Jewish agricultural communities there. his ideas were similar to those later proposed by a number of Zionists. Now, this is before Zionism. This is before Herzl. This is in the 1860s, early 1870s. And he was convinced that Jews should buy land in Eretz Israel, and he also felt that the United States was going to be a prime factor in helping the Jews to regain Israel.
We're speaking with Dr. Yitzhak Levine. He's from Stevens Institute of Technology, Department of Mathematical Sciences, a professor there. But we are speaking to him in his robe, so to speak, as an amazing columnist on American Jewish history, writing for both the Jewish Press and Hamodia and a number of other columns, books, and articles. Now, I wanted to ask one question about President Grant. I had understood President Grant to be anti-Semitic, and yet he's meeting with a prominent Jerusalem rabbi. How did that work?
All right. First of all, the basis of the accusation that Grant was anti-Semitic is his expulsion order of the Jews, which he issued in 1862. Grant was in charge of the Union Army during the Civil War, and he was in charge in Tennessee, Kentucky, and Mississippi. And he issued an order, and there's no question that he signed it, which expelled all of the Jews from those three states. In a very short time, they had to all get out. Even Jews who had lived for 30 years in a certain town in Kentucky were expelled. They had to get out. Why did he do that? The claim is that he, and I'm going to say, why I say claim is because there's a little footnote here. I'm not sure what actually the truth is, but Grant presumably or supposedly was convinced that the Jews were making huge profits in the war effort. They were involved in the black market, charging exorbitant prices, and they were the main people. The fact of the matter is it wasn't just Jews who were involved in making large sums of money, there were many other people. So this order was issued, which he signed. And Jews were given a very short time to leave. What happened was that as soon as this happened, Jews immediately telegraphed President Lincoln. Then they went to Washington, some Jews, and they met with Lincoln, and Lincoln rescinded this order on the spot. And the order, that was the end of it. Now, when Grant ran for president, he was accused of being anti-Semitic. But he claimed that he had signed something without actually reading it. He claimed that a subordinate had drafted this and he hadn't paid attention and he signed it. And that if had he known what was in it, he never would have signed it. And by the way, Grant carried the Jewish vote during his election, interestingly enough. Now, but there's more to it in terms of the fact that Grant invited Jews to the White House when he was president. We know that he met with Rabbi Schneerson. Also, during the dedication of Adas Yisrael congregation in Washington, D.C. in 1874, Grant attended that dedication, but he did more than that. He stayed through the entire service on Shabbos morning.
That's more than most Jews do.
Well, most Jews didn't stay. The dignitary Jews who came left after the dedication. He stayed for the whole thing.
It seems like a lot of what you're talking about is kind of an eerie foreshadowing of what has happened in the last, 10, 15, 20 years, as far as the United States, actually more than 15, 20 years, as far as the United States being a prime benefactor and of Israel, all the issues that you've talked about that occurred in the late 1800s are happening now.
Yes, Schneerson in a certain sense was a visionary. People thought he was crazy when he proposed that the Jews would again live in Israel and have their own state, etc., and that the United States would help them. He was thought to be crazy. It was a crazy idea. Nobody believed anything like that was going to happen. But we know that he was right. We know that he was right. History has proved him right.
All right, well, we're almost out of time. Just one quick question on another subject that I noticed with all your articles and things that you have written. There's something entitled The Man Who Brought Judah Turo Back to Judaism. Now that, of course, I believe, is the Judah Turo, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the Judah Turo who established or helped to establish the Turo Synagogue.
Judah Turo did not establish the Turo Synagogue.
Oh, good, then I'm glad you're correcting
me. The Turo Synagogue was established In 1763, it was completed by the Jews who lived in Newport, Rhode Island. Judah Turow's father, Isaac Turow, was the Chazan there. But because Abraham and Judah Turow, sons of Isaac Turow, left money for the cemetery and for the maintenance of the synagogue, it's called the Turow Synagogue. But Turow himself was estranged from Judaism. He lived in New Orleans. He was a very wealthy man, but he had nothing to do with Yiddishkeit in New Orleans until a gentleman named Gershom Kurshed, K-U-R-S-H-E-E-D-T, had a big influence on him. And in fact, Judah Turow ended up becoming a Shomer Shabbos. We have a letter in which he writes that he's sending a donation, but he couldn't send it on Saturday because it was his Sabbath, and he doesn't write on that day.
All right, if people would like more information about your columns, your writings, how can they get in touch with you? What website can they go to?
Well, let me give an email address, which is easier, okay. I think. Okay. It's L-L-E-V-I-N-E, that's two L's, at Stevens, S-T-E-V-E-N-S, dot E-D-U. L-L-E-V-I-N-E, at Stevens, dot E-D-U. Or if you Google Dr. Yitzhak Levine, a lot of stuff will come up. I'd like to just put in one little footnote about Grant.
Sure.
According to family tradition, Grant, after having read a book called The Vindication of the Israelite Way of Killing Animals, in other words, A Defense of Shechita, by Rabbi Aaron Zev Friedman, after he read that book, he ate only kosher meat for the rest of his life.
Get out.
Now, that's interesting.
That's what it says.
I don't know
if it's true, but to say that he was an anti-Semite is not so clear. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that he signed that order without knowing what it said.
Okay. But he could have thought of it, perhaps, I don't mean to defend it, but he could have thought of it as just a way they were in the midst of a war, and anybody who's profiteering from a war, they would want to take
right.
care of or punish
right.
in one way or another.
But the point is, it wasn't just Jews. There were plenty of other
right.
people who were also making big sums of money. But clearly, when he was president, he had very good relations with the Jews, and he invited a Jew, according to one source, he invited a Jew to join his cabinet, but from what I was able to find out, that I don't know who that was, or I don't believe that person ever joined his cabinet.
All right, well, Dr. Yitzhak Levine, thank you very much for being with us on Awake, Alive, and Jewish. We appreciate it very much.
You are most welcome. Be well, sir.
Okay, bye-bye. Dr. Yitzhak Levine, again, you can email him at llevine@stevens.edu, or just Google Dr. Yitzhak, Yitzhok, Levine. You'll find out about his writings also as a columnist for Hamodia and the Jewish Press. All right, let's talk about this coming weekend, which, of course, is July 4th.
Yes.
And you're having a barbecue, or are you going somewhere?
I think we're